ready for Norma Adams
Blog Talk Radio.
The music is playing, so guess I took a
It's the Morning Show.
Okay, you want to rehearse it one time before we go in there?
With award-winning journalist Cheryl Smith.
I'm good, but I'm not that good.
Bringing you informative, enlightening, thought-provoking, inspiring, and entertaining talk radio.
Everybody, you are watching I Was Just Thinking. I am your host, Norma Adams Wade, and as I tell you every week, I have to remind you because I don't want you to forget, you are my co-host, and I blatantly stole that from Wendy Williams, who we are wishing a speedy recovery from her health issues. Today we've got a wonderful guest, but before I tell you about our guest, let me tell you about my mask. I am determined to honor the health rules of the national health officials, and so I wear a mask. I'm in a building with other people, so I wear a mask, but because I'm in a room by myself, I am going to go ahead and take it off if I can get it off. And then when I leave the room, I will put it back on. Let me get this earring off and go from there. And if you want to call in on the show, now you can put your comments in the chat. Or you can call in on Blog Talk. Now, that Blog Talk phone number, if you've got a pencil and pad, is 646-200-0459. And you can call in and make your comments. 646-200-0459. Guess what, everybody? Our guest today is, first of all, he's an I want to say old friend, but I'll think of a better, more modern description than old friend. But I'll just say Ken and I go way back in the journalism, way back in the journalism and community neighborhood field. And Ken Smith, and you can see him. I'll let him say hello in a minute. I'm going to identify him beginning with him being a former host of Black Forum, which was a public access show on WFAA TV Channel 8 back in the late 70s. And he is a former WFAA TV community relations executive, a community liaison between the station and the African American community in Dallas, that whole Dallas, Arlington, Fort Worth area. Now, today, now Ken could talk about a number of things, but I'm going to try to keep him on track today, and maybe I won't keep him on track, but he will discuss Dallas-Fort Worth area Black Pioneers in Media under the Federal Communication Commission, and that's the FCC, under their mandate back in the 70s or so, late 60s, early 70s, which states that all ethnic groups must have equal access to the public airwaves. Now, Ken Smith also is a South Dallas neighborhood and community advocate. Don't get him started talking about South Dallas. He will inform you about every nook and corner of the area, which he knows very, very well. And he's a business owner and a real estate investor. Good morning, Ken Smith. Oh, I could have gone on that. Don't say few, because I could have gone on and on and on. How are you doing today?
I am doing just fine. I'm just really happy to talk with you again.
Well, great, great, great. Now, listen, speaking of talking, you and I recently talked about what we remember about the early Black pioneers in the Dallas and Fort Worth area journalism field. And as I said earlier, I'll remind you, you're one of those pioneers. And as you, since you were the host of one of those public access shows, the one that was on Channel 8, I'm going to ask you to begin our conversation with your explanation of what that whole public access directive was about. What is the FCC? How did they get into this? What were they trying to say to broadcast media? And why was it important to do that, and how did it, what brought all of that about? Tell us what, from that inside view, what was all that about?
I got my degree in 1975.
Okay.
And that was right in the midst of a real upheaval in media, and it's a good upheaval.
Mm-hmm.
Media at that time, and unless if you're 50 or below, you're not going to remember much about that stuff.
Okay, okay.
Was changing, and you had discussions now about the fairness and equity and ownership, not just the airways and what was being put on the air.
And there's that hot button word, fairness. Wow.
And equity.
Equity.
Equals to equity. But the FCC is the Federal Communications Commission. It is the entity from the very beginning that has regulated radio and television and airwaves.
Okay.
The philosophy behind it is that the airways were created by God. It's something that if you own, you must take the ownership responsibility to represent something that's bigger than your purchase of a frequency.
Right, right.
So you had frequencies that were being given out at beginning in the northern part of the country. And if you notice, many stations that began with the letter W were part of the first wave of radio and television stations.
WFAA being one.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but being an exception.
Oh.
Because it started in the east and went to the west,
like
the migration of people in America.
Yeah.
When you get to mid-America, it was undeveloped.
Okay.
And so you began having Ks as the primary numbers for radio stations, KKDA, KRLD, KBIS. But WFAA, for some reason, got started very early.
Ah.
So it was part of the W wave.
Interesting.
But everything else in Dallas is
K.
So W signifies that it was one of the early media outlets in this area.
Okay.
Now, we go back to airways. You are a steward of the airways.
Uh-huh.
You don't own the airways. You are a steward because how do you own air?
Yeah, now let me jump in there. I just love that explanation. And my mind kind of went there when you first mentioned that. How do you own the air? How are you going to tell people that only a certain ethnic group can use the airwaves, to put their stories out, but there's another group breathing that same God-created air, and they don't have access? I love the way you brought that up.
Well, you know me, I'm a philosophical guy. I just look at things philosophically. But it's difficult for governments to adjust to innovation.
Uh-huh.
Even difficult today.
Mm.
When Mr. Marconi, an Italian inventor, created the radio, he was trying to connect to other people in other countries or whatever, and created something that no one had any knowledge about how it worked or how do you deal with that? How do you legislate something like that or regulate something that is so amorphous?
Yeah.
The same thing is happening right now today.
Mm.
How do you control new computers and laptop and social media? And social media has changed media itself and turned it on its head.
Uh-huh.
And then you have government almost 100% of the time lagging behind trying to figure out how to do this.
Yeah, and let me jump in. Reminding me of, and I'm blanking out on his name, but the owner of Facebook, the creator of Facebook, and all of those problems he's having right now with trying to regulate Facebook, you know, as a social media vehicle.
And, you know, I look at him, and is he 40 yet? I don't.
I'm right there. Uh-huh.
And I'm saying he has a company now called Meta,
mm-hmm.
which is still Facebook. And he's trying to, as an individual and a few key individuals like him,
mm-hmm.
trying to figure out how to negotiate issues that are far beyond his expertise.
Yeah.
He's just an egghead who created something at what, Princeton, to figure out how
mm-hmm.
to speak to all the kids in the school and created something that ended up being a mega $1 billion business. So there's
go
no
figure.
People you go to, you have to run in straight into the headwind and say, we're going to try to do right
uh-huh.
and then figure out how we get this stuff done.
Uh-huh.
Going back to your original question, you have airways, you have people who are able to purchase their little spot and their frequency on the airwave. And then it all becomes kind of a business because
mm-hmm.
they found out advertising was a way to keep it on. That wasn't an original idea.
Okay.
They didn't have advertising, but somebody came up with that, and then advertising was the key part of media, and it still is today.
Mm-hmm.
So. It's how to communicate with people with a new industry, new people, and in the 1970s, which is the aftermath of the 60s revolution, because it was more than the Civil Rights Revolution. There was the Women's Revolution. There was free love.
Right, so right.
Everything was expanding during the late 60s, 70s for more freedom.
Let me jump in at that point. Because I was thinking about some of those very things that you're just naming during that period of time. Now we know about the 50s, which we were still, let's just kind of go through the decades real quickly. We know about the 50s where we were still in integration. Then we came to the 60s with Martin Luther King and the Freedom Riders and all of that and Emmett Till and all of those various during the 60s, all of the assassinations, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, even President John Kennedy, all of those assassinations during the 1960s. Then we got to the 70s with the Black Power Movement, Stokely Carmichael, who became Kwame Ture, and then all of those riots in New Jersey and Detroit and Florida. And then, of course, the growth of the Black Panthers on the West Coast. And then even the Vietnam War, the anti-war protests. And then the women, like you just said. And then in the 80s, we had I would say, mellowed down, for lack of a better term. And we did start making political gains, you know, with the first Black this and the first Black mayor and the first Black elected officials and all of those things. And then, of course, on into the 90s, we had, the 80s, the Martin Luther King federal holiday was passed, and then it was first observed in 86. And then we got on into the 90s with the beating of Rodney King by the LA police. So throughout all of those decades, here we were with media. And who's going to tell these stories from what perspective and from what community? And enter Ken Smith in the 70s to tell the story to people who looked like us
mm-hmm.
on this show called Black Forum on Channel 8. And so you had to be kind of inundated at that point with how to tell that thing.
Well, I'm a nerd.
Okay.
I've always been one. And I always think things through and think real deep about things. And I always see what's behind the issue in front of me
okay.
instead of just the issue.
Okay.
And so I believe that in order to be a journalist, that you have to be a community, a citizen of the world.
Okay.
And you have to look at all these movements. Our memory in America is very short.
Oh, boy.
And our memory in America does not, especially in the 70s and 80s, did not make room for things that were happening internationally. And
oh,
I have
wow.
always said that internationally is where we ought to be moving and thinking in terms of what's happening in the world. SCC is a government bureaucratic organization, and they have all of these people fighting for more access to the airways. You had Native Americans fighting for the airways. We
yeah.
forget that even this troubled time that we were in my opinion, doesn't compare to the 60s and 70s as far as riots and protesting.
I agree.
It's kind of modulated compared to back then because it was first. It was new.
Mm-hmm.
And so the FCC said, let's see if we can create an avenue
okay.
for the voice of all the people who basically did not have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they said, they call it public access, public media programs.
Yeah.
And so these programs began being formed all across the country in the late 60s, early 70s.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And they didn't tell each station exactly what to do. That would be too prescriptive.
Well, see, that's interesting because I did not realize that. Again, you've got that inside view. At that point, I was an audience person watching all of this. So that's interesting. So you did kind of have some latitude.
Yeah, of course. Of course you did. I mean, nobody from the government wants to say, you shall have a media program at 5 o'clock on Sunday.
Okay.
No. But they did provide some samples of what you had to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's all under a rule that still exists.
Okay. Well, let me jump in because that's a great point. I'm jumping around here, but I was curious about the FCC's control in 2021-2022 as opposed to back in the 60s and 70s. Can you talk about that a little bit? Is there much the same? Go ahead and come back to that.
How do you deal with many, many disparate voices wanting access to airways or frequencies
okay.
that they don't own?
Yes.
Okay. Now, at the same time, you have innovators who are black and brown and Hispanic
uh-huh.
Who were beginning to buy media outlets like Bob Johnson.
Okay, BET, yeah, okay.
Entertainment television.
Okay.
I knew Bob, and me and Gloria Marshall and Johnny Hughes, a few others, would meet with Bob when he had BET, and he was explaining BET to us literally across the table.
Okay.
Saying that we're going to start off with a lot of sports programs and football games at colleges, things that would take up 3 and 4 hours of time.
Okay.
The programming base. And an entertainment program, a church presentation, a football game, would kill 2 or 3 hours and be comparatively easy to do. Then it turned into the BET that we know today after Bob sold it
uh-huh.
for $1 billion.
Like that's with a B, right?
With a B.
Yeah. Wow.
Way back then, we weren't talking about billions.
Oh, no.
So you would have these television or radio programs designed for the specific community under the rule called community ascertainment. What that basically means is there is a rule within the FCC that as a steward of the public airways, you are supposed to provide access to those airways to the people who are represented in your community. All communities are different.
Yeah,
if
yeah.
I'm on a reservation, I'm not going to be doing a whole lot of black programming.
Right.
If I'm a totally black community, I'm not going to be doing a whole lot of Hispanic programming.
Right.
I mean that you won't if there's not some places where they intersect, because they are. But you want to be able to, that's why they were not prescriptive. They were saying, this is a guideline and you do it.
Okay.
Then there were, and I want to be clear about something. I don't think that I was the pioneer in the sense of Black Forum on Channel 8.
Well, wasn't there Gene McIntyre?
The producer of that program prior to me, Iola Johnson, was the host. And
I didn't remember Iola with Black Forum.
Jack and Tyre was there. And then it led to, there may have been someone else before me. I'm a little fuzzy on that.
Well, the Clark, that sports guy, Clark, whatever his name was, Clark, there were a lot of African-American male, well, not a lot, a couple or three. Gene McIntyre was not Clark guy, and the other guy who got in legal trouble. They were put in there somewhere because they were recognized figures in the African-American community through the Dallas Cowboys. And
exactly.
So they were put in there somewhere along the way.
And remember, Norma, a lot of original journalists, black, white, brown, were not trained in schools because there were none.
Absolutely. Absolutely, you're right.
Look at some of the giants in media who maybe 70s or 80s, their age. They didn't get a degree from Northwestern and journalism or whatever.
Exactly. Exactly.
So these were people who were part of the local press.
Uh-huh.
So we would be doing ourselves a disservice if we did not say that so many people, so many blacks who entered into the media came in through the pipeline of local minority press. That includes browns, blacks, Indians, women, whatever. They all came in through certain pipelines.
Right.
I had a degree from the University of Houston in journalism, and I went there because I always knew as I wanted to be a reporter or something in the media. That's what I did.
Right.
I was the editor of the newspaper at Lincoln High School in South Dallas.
Okay.
And I went there because there was a gentleman at U of H who was a reporter for the Houston Chronicle who was our teacher as the first and second year.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to get that. I forget his name now.
Mm-hmm.
He's passed away. And that's when I began to learning more about what media was all about. And we had, I remember the most difficult course I had was ethics, media ethics. I didn't get it.
Uh-huh.
I just didn't understand that. I was only 17. So I didn't really get what ethics was all about.
Right.
We went through that, and I did real well, and this guy was with the Boston Globe.
Okay.
He had been with the Boston Globe for years and years, and he was retired, had that Boston accent, but in Houston, which was weird. And I learned so much that this isn't about just going with your recorder to go get an interview from somebody who witnessed a plane crash.
Mm-hmm.
This is to talk about the context that created the situation to make the crash happen in the first place.
Wow.
If you go with a more comprehensive mindset to a story, you bring more out of the story. Now, if I just said, okay, a truck ran into this and somebody died, that would be on the air. But if I investigate and I say, was the road design part of the contributing factors that led to this crash.
Uh-huh.
If I go back and look at all of the data from the Texas Department of Transportation to see that there are crashes in this site all the time.
Correct.
It was a bigger story,
right? And I put that in with crashes at certain intersections, you know, and the neighbors know that there are certain intersections where folk are constantly running into each other. But like you said, until it gets to some sort of governmental level and they start investigating, well, what is it about this intersection? Then maybe some changes might happen.
And many of the legislative changes that have happened in America from the 60s to now are the direct result of media.
Yes.
So, what would happen if we did not have the morning news and the local press and the Observer and the Weekly and
well, you know, I agree with that. I agree with that term that you used to hear a lot. I don't know if it's still used, but media at one time was viewed as the quote unquote fourth estate. They were their own power. And like you said, if something remains in the dark, and there is some kind of famous quote about it, a sunlight, it says something about sunlight is the best disinfectant or whatever. You got to shine the light on it, and that's what media does. Otherwise, it's done in the dark. What's that old club, done in the dark, in the corner, you know, in the back of the room?
Right,
yeah. Exactly. Well, wait a minute. Let me jump in here and bring our audience up to date. We are talking with Ken Smith. Currently, he is an entrepreneur. He's a marketer. He's a media operative. But he's talking to us from his vantage point of being a former, I call him a pioneer in media. And let me just quickly say what brought this conversation about. Ken and I were talking about a colleague, Joseph Bell, who died a few weeks ago at age 92. And I actually did a column about his death and quoted Ken in several points throughout the column. About how Joe, like you said, Ken, he came into media from an education background. He had gotten a bachelor's and master's from Tuskegee Institute, was a high school principal, was a middle school and then high school principal. He was getting ready Dallas superintendent Nolan Essex. He was getting ready to be the first African American assistant superintendent at an all-white school, which was Hillcrest. Back in the day in the 70s, and this opportunity opened up at Channel 4, and Nolan Estes gave him a lead to say, well, you can go over there and try it, but we're going to leave the door open for you from this principal job, which was a door-opening, trailblazing position anyway, and the trailblazing positions were so prominent at that point in time that Joe took the media. So with an educator's background, he ended up being this trailblazing pioneer at Channel 4.
And isn't it interesting that, again, we don't want to ignore the black press or black radio?
Absolutely.
Because if you're the general manager of a large television station, where are, in 1970, where are you going to pull a team of black journalists from?
Wow.
There weren't that many journalists out there. You know, we're getting into college, it was still relatively new.
Yes.
Relatively. I know that that's not absolutely true. Relatively.
But it was,
and
yeah.
So you had to have these pipelines. Mm. And there were many people who were just out there and aggressive, and they were in black radio or they were in black media and the black press. And they got an opportunity to move up to the television things, but not knowing it, not knowing.
Mm.
There was, I look at my history in media, and practically everything I did for the first 20 years, I was the first or among the first.
Yeah.
I didn't even think about it.
Right.
The job was so overwhelming. And as soon as I left Channel 8 and we produced, they asked me to take over this program. I had a degree at
uh-huh.
K104.
Uh-huh.
I was a member of the very first staff of K104. January 26, 1976.
Okay.
I was a member of the first staff along with Duane Caraway.
Okay.
Lloyd
Guy? No, not Lloyd Guy.
Brenda Stewart from Fort Worth, a reporter.
Okay.
Alan, who was my news director and younger than me.
Okay.
And I was 22 and she was 21.
Wow.
And a few of, and the best news director I've ever had was Ruth Allen.
Wow.
And
she's a minister now.
She's a minister and
uh-huh. Allison, Ruth Allen Allison, Ruth Allen Allison, yeah.
So, Dwayne Carraway was a sports reporter. He didn't have experience in sports.
No.
He graduated from Texas Southern, and I went to U of H. They were two blocks apart.
Right.
So we've just known each other. He was with the Roosevelt. I went to Lincoln. So we've known each other all lives.
Yeah.
So it was kind of wide open because there was no set pattern on who was going to take over these shows until the late 70s when you began to have a lot of people with media credentials.
Uh-huh.
To the play. They had their degree from Northwestern or Columbia or this or whatever. And then it began to open up with people who had different experiences. But there was room enough for everybody to come into the play.
Right.
Now, was it easy and did you have challenges? No. I remember K104 was a classical music station.
Can you imagine that?
Classical music. And on January 26, 1976, at 12 noon, Sherry Jones was the very first voice as a disc jockey.
Okay.
And the very first song ever played was Earth, Wind, and Fire, Sing a Song.
Get out.
So they went from Beethoven's Fifth to Earth, Wind, and Fire, Sing a Song.
Oh, my gosh.
The phones lit up, and I can't even get into all the things that people were saying.
Well, wait a minute. Negative or positive?
Negative. You were listening to elevator music at home all day long, and then you hear Earth, Wind, and Fire. And I remember so many controversies that we had in programming because many of us pushed the envelope.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the big struggles that I had at Channel 8 was I really wanted to do something on the Black Muslims.
Okay.
And I also said to the producer, the executive director, when they were hiring me, I said, I will not do a studio-based show only.
Okay.
There has to be a studio component.
Okay.
I said, don't even talk to me unless we're able to get out in the community.
Well, hold on. Let me jump in there because and take you back to something you said earlier. You mentioned that there was a thing called ascertainment. Wasn't that one of your responsibilities? And tell us what did you have to do?
I was the director of community relations or community engagement.
Okay.
That included, in many stations, that was two different. That you had a person who did just that governmental regulation thing.
I got you.
And then you had people who did programming.
Okay.
I did them both.
Okay.
And basically, community ascertainment just says your news, your public affairs programming needs to reflect the concerns of the community.
Okay.
The white community, the black community, whatever.
Everybody.
It's different. So here comes these radio television programs, and even programs that were not necessarily for the minority audience. Then we began having more kind of entertainment news sort of things because people were looking for more entertainment as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had that big conversation between news people and public affairs people and entertainment people saying, what is news? 30 years ago, if a big-time entertainer passed, unless it was somebody really, really, really big, that didn't become your news.
Yeah.
So that was on the internews. That was on the entertainment show. Bob Saget, the comedian who died the other day, was 65. That would have never made the news.
And it's 24/7 now.
Yeah.
We're going to be hearing about, although I loved him, I love Saget, but we're going to be hearing about him constantly.
So you just have to navigate new things.
Yeah.
And I was saying I will not be landlocked into the studio during interview.
Okay.
I just will not. Of course we had to do that. But did I understand in my head what that really required? I did not.
Okay.
Because back then, in order to go outside to do a video shoot, you had to take a CPU unit, which is this big, huge, clunky machine. You couldn't do it with a camera over your shoulder. You had to have the CPU unit, which was kind of like a outside control panel.
What? Wait a minute now, because I know very little about broadcast. I'm a print person. You had to take that thing?
We had to have a crew just to go out and do interviews. And
okay.
Then the executive producer was telling me, listen, Ken, interviews are much better to be done in a place where it's controlled and contained.
Uh-huh.
If you take a camera out, you're going to hear the street noise. You're going to hear airplanes go over, and we had to fight all that.
Right.
But then we had to find a way to be more nimble.
Okay.
So it was me. We worked with the news department. We were not a part of the news department, but we worked closely. I forged a bond between the news department and the public affairs department. I'm 22 years old.
pushy black male.
Between the news department and the news director felt the simpatico between the two of us.
Okay.
And so let's work together.
Okay.
They offered me a job in the news department that I turned down.
Oh, I didn't know that. I did not know that.
Very good salary at the time.
Wow.
Didn't know it, but I'm glad I turned it down, because that's when I got a call from the PBS station, the local PBS station, and said, we need a producer for the Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee television program series on PBS.
Okay.
Programs produced by Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee.
Now, that's our channel 13.
And they came to me, and I said, I don't have any experience in that. And they said, we know what you can do, and we think you can do it. So they had more faith in me than me.
Wow.
And I did it. It was the toughest job I ever had in my life.
Wow.
13 programs with, you know, famous actors and things. I just felt overwhelmed. But you know what? You eat an elephant the same way you eat a chicken.
One bite at a time. Right.
And we ended up winning a New York Film Festival Award for short drama. And we did a drama on the Pullman Porters. They were all black. And then during the time when the railroad was changing, they began moving out the blacks and moving into Scandinavia.
Right. Now, let me just bring our audience to that point. Okay, here you were in the Dallas area, and Dallas wasn't the big mega that it is now, I don't believe, at that time, but you were doing
media,
these...
In media, it was.
Okay.
Because
go ahead.
WFAA, which means it was part of the first wave.
Okay.
So we got into the wave of television far sooner than others who
had... I got you. But here you were doing this local, and this door opened for you to work with national figures like Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis, two names that were just internationally known in entertainment, both as African Americans and as just actors in general. And this door opened for you, Ken Smith, born in Dallas, to go.
And I was 24.
And you were 24 years old.
We had a $4 million budget, and it would be my responsibility as a senior producer to manage the budget. And I took it one step at a time. I had to end up firing people.
Wow.
Hiring 30 people.
Oh.
Hiring people that I, what did I know about costume design and set decoration?
Oh, my gosh.
What? I learned it.
Yeah.
I learned it.
Yeah.
And I think Bob Ray Sanders, I give him so much credit for seeing in me something that I did not see in myself at 24. My head was still down trying to learn things.
Wow.
But I recognized that it helped me build confidence to know that you can do things far beyond what you think you can do if you just, first of all, you got to face it.
Right.
Then once you face it, you can go just break off each point.
Uh-huh.
The budget was the easiest thing. That's adding and subtracting. Didn't have Excel spreadsheets, but we did have these little papers. I ended up firing the union manager, who was twice my age.
Wow.
Because he simply would not follow my instructions.
Wow. So
if you're fired, I'm going to be the unit manager.
Yeah.
So I was the unit manager too.
Right.
And so the freedom to be innovative, I appreciate Channel 8 and Channel 13 for allowing me to do that, but I also came to them with ideas that they had to challenge.
Yeah.
Now, the story I was about to tell, and I'll be brief, we wanted to do something at Channel 8 on the black Muslims.
Okay.
That was a really important group that was emerging in the 70s.
Okay. We're in the 1970s at this point. Okay.
70s. And so I, of course, studied Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X and all this. And
right.
They broke off from the black Muslims to become, you know, Muslims, but the black Muslims at that time still remained.
Okay.
And they were growing in Dallas. and I wanted to do the story, and the station says, no.
Yeah.
We're not going to do this.
Right.
So I got with Marty Haig, and I said, help me.
Now, he's the top man. Haig was the top
man in news.
Okay.
And I said, help me form a rationale to take that to the station managers, because this is news.
Yeah.
And there was a thin line between public affairs and news. I think they were still pretty much the same thing.
Mm.
And this was a news story.
Yeah.
Marty said, we can't do it because you know the stuff. Do you know? Norm. I went ahead and produced the program of a 30-minute documentary that I learned to edit myself.
Oh, my gosh.
We had an editor that edited all of our stuff.
Oh, my.
And I sat there and I watched Ann do all this editing for a year or so. And I said, and I would go back at night when the editing bays were not open. I edited this 30-minute program that we had shot in the field.
And from about several hours, I guess, of shooting.
Oh, my God. You always take 4 or 5 hours down.
And then you had to edit this down to 30 minutes. Oh, my gosh.
Yes. And Marty saw it.
Yeah.
Came to me and says, he said, who edited this for you?
Whoa.
I said, I did. He said, where did you learn to edit? I said, watching Ann.
Oh, my gosh.
He said, we don't have anyone in this station who can do what you're doing.
Oh, my gosh.
I said, okay. I said, I'm saying, oh, okay. And it was no problem to get the show on the air because it was a documentary that was just good enough for the news department to do, but I did it myself.
Oh, my gosh.
And we got so much response because it wasn't taking on any particular opinion about what the Muslims
did. You were putting the facts out there.
Putting it out there.
Mm-hmm.
And putting it out there, and you determine.
Yeah.
Going to be. There were some things that they didn't want to talk about. Their issues with how they treated women was very disheartening, you know, to people that you were kind of like second stepchild in a way.
Right.
But they didn't want to talk about that, but we talked about it because we had to. And
this is still the 1970s when all of Black Power, Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, Black Panthers, all of that's out there.
These are the challenges that you bring yourself and who you are to the role of what you do.
Right.
And the wider perspective that you have, the greater point of view that you have. And I thank God every day for my family. I get burkling up every time I think about it. But my aunt, who I think you knew as my teacher, lived in Paris, and Israel.
She was my French instructor in high school, Willie Burke Anderson, Mademoiselle.
The world was open to us through the conduit of my aunt traveling to Mexico City and living in Mexico City and Puerto Rico, Israel. In the 90s, she had more experience than any white teacher in DISA.
Easily. Mm-hmm.
And she became the very first foreign language coordinator when they opened up Skyline in 1970.
Willie Burke Anderson.
All the foreign language cluster, 13 languages, she was over that whole thing.
Wow.
That same year.
Now, she was born around in the 20s or 30s?
She died at 96 years old.
She died at 96, yeah.
So she was born like in 05, 06.
Oh, okay.
So my brother was the first Black history professor at Skyline. And
okay.
Over the first Black history, Roland Edison created the very first Black history studies program. They wrote the curricula along with Grace Akbar at Skyline High School.
Okay.
Yes. So these are my mentors, my brother and my aunt. My father's oldest sister literally ran the house for Henry Kaiser. Kaiser Aluminum?
Yes.
Lived in Hawaii, and she ran the entire estate for Henry Kaiser.
Wow.
So when you have exposure And my brother, my twin brother, worked for the airlines. And so
let me jump in right quick and just tell our audience, and I'd like to have our guests to give just a little synopsis about their background. So let's use this point right now. Everybody, we're talking with Ken Smith about pioneers of African-American descent who entered media in the 70s and made all sorts of, blazed all kinds of trails. Kind of give us the pitch about the young Ken Smith, where you were born, and you were talking to us about your family, and just a little synopsis about that.
One of my favorite TV shows, The Maritime Boy Show, and Ted Baxter, the news guy.
Right.
He would always say, "Well, it started in a one-room shack in Appalachia." No, that's not the case. But I was born and raised in South Dallas. I live in the house that I grew up in, right off of Hatcher.
Okay.
Went to Lincoln High School. I was editor of the newspaper at Lincoln.
The Lincoln Lantern.
Yes. And I knew that's what I wanted to do. So there was no mystery about going to college and what I wanted to do. That's what I wanted to do.
Right.
I had this fantastic family background that showed us the world was certainly achievable.
Mm.
Because, I was getting letters from Israel and France every day. So it was just never odd for me to think globally.
Yeah.
One of the cool things that helped shape me is the fact that my brother worked for Pan Am.
Okay.
And so at that time...
Now, you're a twin. Like you said, you are
a twin.
Mm-hmm.
An identical twin, and I could get 75% discount for anywhere Pan Am went, which is everywhere in the world.
Okay.
So I would get on a plane and go to India.
Wow.
New Zealand.
Take me next time. Take me.
In Africa, I've been to like 20 countries in Africa.
Oh, my gosh.
And when I would go, I would study the languages. I would study the people. I would study their revolutions. And I saw a pattern. The pattern is we praise the independent movements. Everybody does. You know, you're overthrowing, an oppressive government, and you,
right.
You win your independence. Fantastic. Nobody's criticizing that.
Right.
The missing piece in practically all revolutions like that is your charismatic leader doesn't have governmental and financial background.
Every time.
Start a stock market, right?
Right.
So it's great to be free, like Haiti.
Yeah.
The very first democracy in the Western Hemisphere,
right.
Was Haiti.
Yeah, yeah.
In the 1700s, they overthrew the French.
Mm. Mm.
That's a big deal.
Mm. Mm.
But what did the French do right after the revolution? They created a blockade, and so no supplies were able to get into Haiti, and they starved it.
Mm.
And it's the same way today as it is as it was 400 years ago.
Wow. Right.
So what I'm saying is not that I'm opposed to revolution. Of course not. That's ridiculous. But what I am saying is in order to build a nation,
mm-hmm.
you need more than the passion for the desire to be free. You need to have the mechanics so that you can create an economy.
Okay, now let me jump in. And, gosh, you know you and I could go on forever. We're at it's about 12:20, and maybe we can go a little past 12:30 if that fits your schedule. We've got a lot of ground to cover, but you make a point that I just want to really jump in on. Yeah, passion is great, which I heard you say, but how do you? I mean, once these revolutionaries start, like you just said, I don't think they're thinking organizationally. They're thinking passionately, and they're looking at an injustice that they want to make be a justice.
Right.
How do we get over that? How do we get to being organized?
The civil rights movement, which you and I are very close to, was the model for simply just about all revolutions thereafter,
uh-huh.
because it was based upon a plan.
All right.
It was a plan. It was an architectural plan.
Mm-hmm.
The people, we give credit, so much credit to Malcolm X and to Martin Luther King,
mm-hmm.
and they deserve
every bit,
that they need to get.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't pay the same amount of allegiance to the architects behind the scenes.
Okay.
These are people who are dull, nerdy, have no charisma, but they can put a plan together. We celebrate Rosa Parks, but the lady just died who was the Rosa Parks before Rosa Parks was the Rosa Parks.
Correct.
There were so many Rosa Parks.
Yeah.
They had all of these ladies
who
were ready to go on the train. It happened to be Rosa Parks happened to be at the right place.
Right. And a name that sticks out to me in history a lot, Bayard Rustin, who was behind the whole Martin Luther King SCLC thing. And I admire him so, and I don't know hardly enough about him, except to know that the man filled a big role.
He was the architect, amongst many others.
Mm.
I look at an excerpt of Sidney Poitier's book.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a book that he wrote in 2010.
Uh-huh.
It talked about Harry Belafonte, and I think it was in a newspaper just the other day.
Okay.
Harry Belafonte and Henry Poitier went to Mississippi in 1964.
Mm-hmm.
Their job was to deliver $70,000 that they had collected for the movement and to provide it to SNCC because they were not able, and we don't think about this.
Mm-hmm.
If you raised money in Alabama for civil rights, where are you going to put the money? In the bank?
No, under the mattress,
You couldn't put it in the bank.
Mm-mm.
So they had a way, they figured out a way to get Sidney Poitier, who had been in movies,
mm-hmm.
down the Mississippi. It's kind of hard to find, to hide Sidney Poitier, who didn't speak the same accent that
right.
he spoke.
Right.
The KKK knew about the fact that Sidney was coming, and they didn't know, and they had a truck that bumped their car 3 times.
Wow.
Before they got to their final destination.
Wow.
So they finally delivered the money to the SNCC people through churches and circuitous routes, through back alleys and all sorts of things. And they came in to this thunderous applause. Why am I telling you this?
Mm-hmm.
There is a financial aspect to the civil rights movement that we do not talk about.
Nor really don't know about, Ken. I don't think we...
You have to be funded.
Okay.
That's why the nerds like Bayard Rustin and other people don't get the credit for the funding. Where the women have such a great role. What is the lady who always wore the hats in D.C. and invited all the people to come to her house?
In D.C.
Always had a height. That was her height. Dorothy Height.
Oh, Dorothy Height. Of course.
Dorothy Height wasn't just a social maven.
Uh-huh.
Dorothy Height was a fundraiser.
Okay.
You don't have people at your house to have cake and don't ask them for $1,000.
Okay.
So you had to have money. All the money did not come from the Jewish connection.
Okay.
It came from churches, and there had to be an avenue because you couldn't use any banks.
Okay.
Mm. So that's what I'm saying when we talk about revolution. We take the emotional aspect of it, which you have to have,
mm-hmm.
and you celebrate the fact that we've won our freedom. Now the hardest part comes, how do we build an economy?
Okay.
How do we build roads? How do we build a stock market?
Uh-huh.
How do we have food to feed ourselves? How do we protect ourselves with arms? That requires money.
Okay.
Usually a freedom fighter is a person who is kind of a guerrilla tactic toward a person who fights and can vote. And you need that too.
Okay, let me jump in right quick. And I know we're going to try to got a lot to cover in a short amount of time. But I wonder about Stacey Abrams today in Georgia, this whole Build Back Better movement. I'm wondering, do you see her as being sort of a modern-day Dorothy Height, or has she gone off into a whole different sphere? I don't think she's really more of a fundraiser as a people organizer. I don't know.
Well, I think that's a real good question that kind of doesn't have an answer.
Uh-huh.
The situations aren't the same.
Okay.
I was anticipating that you were going to ask, you know, comparing journalists now to journalists in the 70s.
Right.
What I was going to say, if you had asked that, was how do you compare when the world has changed? News is not cemented in ABC, CBS, NBC, and big newspapers.
Right.
Most people get their news from other sources.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the media has changed. So it's kind of hard to compare a Dorothy Height
and a Stacey Abrams.
And a Stacey Abrams, because their world is so different. Stacey Abrams almost won the governor's election.
She's a
skillful politician.
Uh-huh.
She elevated voting rights to a new level equal to voting rights in the 60s.
Right.
So I see her as very, very important. She's very articulate. She's passionate. She can communicate with people on different levels.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't it interesting that Georgia becomes kind of a center again?
Yeah.
Why? Because Atlanta especially has a thriving middle class.
Right.
Thriving businesses. Unique opportunities. The site of the Atlanta Olympics in 80, whatever that was. And you see that it's a different place than, say, Dallas.
Uh-huh.
And for many, many different reasons. But going back to that community ascertainment, you can't put a public affairs program show in Atlanta to meet Dallas's needs or vice versa.
Uh-huh.
It has to be about what's happening there.
There.
And that is ground zero.
Okay.
Again.
And again, it gets back to what those people there want in their environment. Okay, now let me use that as a jumping off point. I want to, for you to kind of walk us through, and I'm going to name these various public access shows. Now, on Channel 4, we had Insights, which was hosted by Rochelle Brown, a name that we all remember, and Joe Bell was manager behind the scenes of that show. In just a few words, what are your thoughts on Insight? Insights.
So many people got the two confused. And I realized that people kind of saw the public affairs programs kind of all the same.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why I wanted to make sure mine had a certain twist, which is we're going to be outside.
Okay, now hold that point. Let me rush through to Channel 5, WBAP, at public access show was Opportunity Line. Now, here's a name that is absolutely not known. The host of that show was an African-American entrepreneur whose name was Cullen McCoy, a massively gifted, skilled entrepreneur. He ended up owning the Dallas Express, which he purchased somewhere in the mid-70s, I think, but that paper was founded in 1892, and he was the last owner of that. Cullen McCoy has a really, really interesting entrepreneurial history. Just a quick take from you on Channel 5 Opportunity Line. And I noticed the name Opportunity Line kind of relates to me with what he did. Go ahead.
And you know, Norma, I don't have to admit, I'm not familiar with the program at all.
And that's my whole point. My whole point, yeah.
So I looked up thinking that we'd anticipate this, and this is one of the things that's different between then and now. Back in the day,
right,
if we can say it, these are a few magazines and newspapers that we had.
Okay.
And these were black businesses that made money.
Okay.
In Sepia.
Yes.
Dallas, Fort Worth.
Uh-huh.
Started in the 1950s.
Okay.
The Dallas Gazette started in 1893.
See, I didn't know that went back that far. Isn't that interesting? Mm. That's about the same time that the Dallas Express. Cullen came in late in the game to purchase it.
Absolutely.
But yeah, in the 1890s,
exactly. We had
In Sepia, Dallas Gazette.
The Italian Review, 1949, the Knights of Pythias?
Yes, yes.
They had their own paper called the Pythian Review.
Uh-huh.
The Post Tribune.
Right.
The Elite News, which is still owned by the Blair family.
Correct, correct.
The Dallas Examiner.
Yes.
Remember that?
I do. I do. Well, and Dallas Examiner, of course, is still very much in operation. Yeah.
The Monday Night Talk.
Her dad was Fred Finch, very respected attorney, African-American attorney, Fred Finch, who was one of the founders.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Right there on Malcolm X still.
Correct, correct, correct.
Remember Tony Davis and the Dallas Weekly?
Oh, absolutely. Still going. Different from Tony's paper, but still going.
He was a character, and he sold it to Jim Washington.
Uh-huh.
And his son and daughter run the paper.
Right.
We had the African Herald, started in 1992.
See, now I'm not that familiar with the African Herald.
Okay. Then we had the Dallas Community Leader.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one.
Mm-hmm. In 87.
Mm-hmm.
The Dallas Independent Review in 1962.
Mm,
so
that was missing me.
It's a lot of places where we would get our news when we couldn't get it, because if you went to the Dallas Morning News, I mean, we did not exist. You know,
until Julius got read. But let me go on with, okay, so Cullen McCoy was at Channel 5 with Opportunity Line. Now, at the same time, at Channel 11, this name, Jerry Thomas. Now, that name goes way back to black radio, but Jerry Thomas was a smooth-talking, smooth-voiced person, commentator, and he hosted What About People on Channel 11. And he actually interviewed a couple of presidents. He interviewed Ronald Reagan. He interviewed Jimmy Carter. And while he was, when he began hosting this show in 63, that was when all of those assassinations happened. And then he was there. He was at Channel. Get this. This man whose name is just not known was at Channel 11 hosting this public access show for the African-American community for 26 years, and he left in 89. And then, of course, you at Channel 8, and like you said, prior to you, Jim, Gene McIntyre, and then Iola at one point. I just simply can't remember Iola hosting that show, but I believe it. And then, of course, you came on. And then the last one, huh?
Lloyd Geist.
Okay, Lloyd Geist. That's a name that fairly kind of was recognized. And then the last station was Channel 13. Of course, Bob Ray Sanders, who was just a print, broadcast, airwaves. I mean, Bob Ray was all over the place. And his shows were News Edition and On the Record. And so in all of those stations during that time, we're trying to accommodate the Federal Communications Commission and make the airwaves accessible to all ethnic groups.
And let me say two things that I didn't say.
Uh-huh.
I never saw public affairs program as all the stuff you got to do.
Okay.
You know, all of that stuff over there.
Okay.
I saw public affairs programs as a marketing tool that would bring in advertising dollars. From the very beginning, at 22 years old, I said, we're going to make money on this show.
Okay.
One of the things that I said we're going to do. And we did.
Mm.
Then there was an association created of public affairs managers across the nation that would have biannual meetings.
Oh, see, what was that group?
Yes.
Was that the Floria Marshall group?
No.
No, it wasn't that one.
No, this was radio and television public affairs managers, and they had a group that would have two meetings once a year, and it was great.
Wow.
And I remember thinking that, you know, because these are big people, I'm 20-something years old, these are big-time people, I'm going to this meeting, you know, what do I know? and listen, I would show tapes of our some of the things we were doing in Dallas, and all these people would be coming to me after the meetings and all saying, "How do you do this? How did you do that?"
Right.
We just did it. And I realized that if you bring innovation, bring innovative ideas, people will be attracted to it. And I have to give credit to Arthur Gray, who was a salesperson at Channel 8. Arthur said to me, "Listen, I got this home builder building homes in South Dallas at Oak Cliffs, and the homes aren't selling."
Hmm.
He convinced them to advertise on Black Forum.
Okay.
And so he took me out with him to meet with the buyers.
Okay, what period of time are we talking? What period of time?
70s.
In the 70s. Okay.
And we, I guess I could say this now that it's 40 years after. To sell the homes.
Okay.
I mean, I looked at the homes. It's certainly nothing. There weren't special homes, but they were certainly nice homes. And so I said, "Well, I have no issue with the homes. They're fine." So what we did was we created a stream of people to go through to look at the houses.
Okay.
So we created a stream through our networks.
Okay.
And through that stream, guess what?
What?
They
actually bought them. Wow.
So this was a connection between programming, advertising, and people getting a commodity.
Wow.
That's why I always thought public affairs programs should be money generators for the station.
But let me say this. And you correct me if I'm wrong. I'm probably wrong. Do you think the significance of advertising is known or even appreciated? I mean, the general public, do we recognize the value of advertising?
I don't think we recognize to the extent to which it controls our lives.
Okay.
And I think now the advertising is on social media doesn't cost nearly as much because it's not broadcasting.
Okay.
I equate social media with magazines.
Okay.
Now, magazines are specialty. If I want to know about fishing, a car repair, there's a magazine for every little thing like that. They're specialized. Then you had, people may not realize this if they're young, but then remember you used to have general magazines like Life and Look.
Yeah.
They bit the dust because America was no longer generalized. We were now claiming and clattering for specificity. More specific things to us, and so Life and Look went
away.
Right. So social media, you can advertise on social media for next to nothing because you know that you have a smaller audience.
Uh-huh.
But sometimes now with these algorithms through Google and others, you have a million people.
Okay.
But you know you're reaching them because you can do the analytics through Google and others to find out how many people you're listening to. So we're getting to, we're going back to an era of specialization. Therefore, I don't have to listen to Lester Holt and David Muir on ABC and NBC News at 5:30 to get my news. I've heard everything they're going to say by the time 5:30 even comes around.
That's so true.
I've seen it. I want to give credit to Cheryl Smith. Before I get out of the bed every morning, I have read through the entire morning news on my phone.
Okay.
And the entire Metro news.
Okay.
I don't get up until I've read those two things.
Wow.
Because I get the morning news perspective and I get the Metro perspective.
Okay.
And I combine them together. And there are a lot of times.
I know she'll be very happy to hear that.
I told her that.
Right.
And then there's the Dallas Free Press, which is a Instagram-based news about South Dallas and West Dallas. And it's staffed primarily by interns. And their focus is on South Dallas and West Dallas. And they go dig and they go in deep. Most people haven't heard of it. But they will, because the goal is to bring out your tentacles, Grab more people, grab more people, grab more, and sooner or later, you're going to be a big dog.
Okay, now let me jump in. I'm trying to wrap in. I want to get to this point. Again, we're picking your brain from the perspective of a media of an African American who was a pioneer in broadcast media during the time when the federal government under the FCC was reaching with all kind of tentacles to bring more of people of ethnic groups into using the free public airways. So my question to you, when we look at obstacles along the way from your vantage point and that up against proud achievements or things that make you feel good when you look back over that whole scenario going back to the 60s and 70s and on up currently, what obstacles stick in your side? And then your proud achievements. Give us that range, obstacles and your proud achievements.
I don't see obstacles. I step over them.
Okay.
You know they're there.
Yeah,
you know they're coming, and I think two and three steps ahead.
Okay.
So I just see them as stepping stones.
Okay.
But, you know, everybody's not like me.
Okay. Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. You gotta quickly under this obstacle banner. You gotta, without naming names, tell that story that I heard you tell about a manager at, I think it was a radio station or something, maybe not, but who in your face told you he wanted to see you fail. That you reminded him too much of what he had not done. Just quickly summarize that story.
I'm gonna be real general here, but one day, a fellow reporter at a radio station called me in, and he says, "I hate you."
Ooh.
I thought he was
out.
I really thought he was joking. And I said, "What are you talking about?" He says, he said, "I come here to try to find ways to make you fail."
Ooh. Sounds like the Democrats and the Republicans. Or the Republicans and the Democrats.
I said, "Well, why are you doing that?" I mean, I at that time had no issue with the person. I said, "You've obviously been covering up a whole lot of animus, you know, for a long time, very well. Because I don't even understand. I'm 22 anyway.
Right, right.
What do I know? I don't know a thing." And what it ended up being was I didn't even take it harshly because they were older.
Yeah.
My age.
Right.
And here was this new field opening up that he felt he was slightly over the hill for.
Right.
And then here I am sitting right next to him being able to take advantage of that.
So it's
a story that anybody in any business can tell. There's nothing unique to me or to that person. But we never were enemies. Because we kept on talking, and I kept moving on. I went from there to some other stations and kept doing some things. But I said, it's up to you to see whether or not you are going to succeed for yourself.
Wow.
You know, just because you were at a 40s, 50s, 80s didn't mean you were over the hill.
Wow.
Look at the people, Jerry Thomas. Look at all the people that you had named that started that point.
Yeah.
It goes back to the story, the moral I think we want to put into people. You are the person who limits yourself the most.
Well, see, that is so true of this person that you're talking about. Rather than saying, you know, young man, you've been able to do A, B, C, and D. I wasn't able to do it. I'm so proud that this door has opened for you. I want to do everything I can to help push you forward. But he didn't do that. He took the complete opposite.
He wasn't a bad guy. He wasn't a bad guy. He was honest enough to sit down in a room one-on-one to tell me. The simple fact that he did that face-to-face told me he was more hurt and disappointed than he really was angry and hateful.
Okay. I can see that. I'll accept that.
Say that in front of somebody, that means he was vulnerable and open and not vindictive. Because
okay.
I'm shocked because our relationship had been so good and remained good.
Right, right.
He had to get that out, and perhaps that was help and cathartic for him.
It had to be. It had to be. Okay, but now let's move on to things you're proud of when you look back. Achievements.
Well, those personal achievements, I will never, ever, ever, I think, surpass that 1 year I worked with Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee.
Okay.
That was the most difficult challenge I had in my 24 years at the time.
Wow.
I had never fired, well, I had fired somebody before. I had fired one other person. But firing people and all that, that just wasn't new to me.
Right.
Here you had two people who knew a lot about production and
the whole nine, right?
And they knew all this literature. I mean, they could quote scripture, books, and also say, "I wasn't that way." And yet, I'm sitting there developing story ideas with people who had just done a movie.
Yeah.
And I'm hiring a costume designer and fighting, and I had some fights with Ruby, not Austin, Ruby.
Okay.
But they were good fights, the tension that you need to have to get something better.
Yeah, yeah.
And she was testing me, too. I found out a little bit later on she was testing me. And after it was over, the whole program was over, we won the New York Film Critics Award and everything.
Wow.
She says, "I knew you could do it." She said, and this is what she said. And she said, "The thing I like about you is that you are." And that's what I said, what is that?
How do I interpret that? Is that just direct and to the point, or? That's what she meant.
Just incisive.
Okay.
Straight to what is needed for the time. You don't add any more or any less. You don't make it a bigger deal than it needs to be. You resolve the issue at the time. And she was absolutely right. That is how
That's your MO. That's your MO.
I'm not trying to bring you up, bring you down. I'm just saying we need to solve a problem. Solve this problem. Let's get on.
Okay, now let's wrap up.
Yes, ma'am.
Any points, and we'll just have to have you back another time, but any points that we didn't get to that you feel we just really got to mention them, or any future plans that you want to talk about?
Let's name names, even if we're going to forget them.
Okay.
Let's name names.
Okay.
I wrote some of mine.
Go ahead, please.
These are names of people in the 70s and 80s who I guess were in the pioneer bucket.
Okay.
And we both know that we're gonna miss some folks.
Absolutely.
Some guys going in. But Denise Bunkley Perkins.
Okay.
She's a news producer, and you're not out front.
Okay.
You're never going to be out front. You're behind the scenes.
Uh-huh.
You're not going to know. But she produced the news at Channel 4.
Okay.
Phyllis Watson was
an
anchor. Phoebe Tree.
Mm-hmm.
Stayed a short time.
Mm-hmm.
John Jenkins was a photographer. A photographer is a journalist.
Okay.
He rose the ranks from photographer up to the news manager at Channel 4.
Okay, let me throw in Alexis Yancey, a producer at WFAA. Throw that name in. Mm-hmm.
I tell you, let's do one. You do one, I do one.
Okay.
Iola Johnson, the anchor extraordinaire.
Right. I'm going to throw in, you said Phyllis Watson. Ramona Logan. I'll throw her in. Right.
Sharon West was a radio news and entertainment person.
Now, didn't she have daughters also in the industry?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Exactly.
Right. Oh, I'll throw in Steve Pickett, even though he's still on the scene, but I think
Pickett borders both groups.
Okay.
A pioneer and a newbie. He's kind of in that in-between group.
Okay.
Deborah Martin.
Yes, Deborah Martin. Now, Stephen Giles, who
Clarice
Tinsley. They're a couple. They're a married couple. He was like a cameraman or something like that. Yeah.
He started off as a photographer and became a salesperson and then his own business. So based upon who you are as a person, you can navigate where you want to be.
Right.
If you have a broader vision. Ron Nance,
Oh, yeah. See.
He was a photographer.
Right. That is so true. That's so true.
And he was a videographer for the Oscar Davis and Ruby Dee show.
Now, I'm going to cheat and name two. Gary Reeves and Sean Rabb. I'm going to put Gary Reeves and Sean Rabb. Mm-hmm.
All right. Johnny Hughes.
Yes.
He was a reporter at KKDA. She and I formed the Dallas Black Media Coalition.
Right. And you have to put a / community advocate with her because Johnny
right.
Hughes was on the in media, but she was on the streets in the community. On the streets and in your face.
We were like Mutt and Jeff.
Okay. Well, let's name one more, and then I'm going to have to wrap up because I want
okay. A name that no one ever mentions, Lonzie Lees. He was one of these news reporters who didn't have a lot of the training. But boy, did he have the ability to go in there and get the news and go make people uncomfortable and get it done.
Now, do you know if is he still with us?
I don't know.
Yeah, nor do I. But I very much remember him. Well, listen, we're going to wrap up. We're going to put a pin in that. Ken Smith, we cannot thank you enough for allowing us to pick your brain.
Slim picking.
Yeah. Not slim at all. We look forward to having you back with us. Thank you for spending this time with us. Yes, go ahead.
Two people said to me after the news article that you wrote last week.
Okay.
Without excuse, the two of you, us, of creating an exhibit that will be featured at the African American Museum of the History of Black Press in Dallas area.
Oh, that's
great idea. If we put that burden on ourselves, let's do that.
That's too wonderful. Too wonderful. Ken Smith, thank you. We will talk again.
All right.
Bye-bye now. Wow. That's all I can say. That's all I can say is wow. We're going to hurry and review a few community events. We want to talk about, we know that the observance of Martin Luther King's birthday is coming up, and the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Center has a whole lineup of events, and also at the same time, the Realizing the Dream Healthy Living Expo is scheduled. Now, the expo will be at the African American Museum, and that will be Monday, January 17. Now, we know King's birthday is January 15. He was born in 1929. And the Monday, the 17th, is the national holiday. And so at the Healthy Living Expo, it is an expo. There will be all kind of resource people there. And one of the points that we want to point out is that there will be booster shots given. Adults can get any of the two, Pfizer or Moderna and the booster. And then children of 5 to 12 will be able to get the Pfizer, I believe it's the Pfizer vaccine. There will be gift cards given. And so you want to come out to the African American Museum. It'll be all day on January 17th, which is the actual holiday for a king. And you do want to come and just partake of all these activities. I mean, everything from college, from college scholarship information, voter registration, educational information. There'll be all kind of vendors and speakers and programming geared toward building strong families. There will be financial literacy, telling us how to better use our money. There will be I said about health, and it's healthy living, so that's one of the key points of the expo. And Dr. King, one of the quotes that the expo is using is his quote that one of the questions that he always asks, what are you doing for others? And so this, the sponsors, and this is sponsored by the Don't Believe the Hype Foundation. And so, and of course, you know, part of the whole King scenario is you do public service. And so what are you doing for others? Where this expo is giving points, all kind of points on how to live more healthy. And also, so you want to, and you can go online and get more information about it. It's the Realizing the Dream Healthy Living Expo, and you can go to Facebook and type it in. Follow Realizing the Dream Healthy Living Expo on Facebook and get more information. Now, the Martin Luther King Community Center, all their whole lineup of events. The first event started this week with the wreath laying ceremony that was yesterday. Now, the Alpha Phi Alpha men, of course, King was an alpha, and they laid a wreath yesterday at the, and all of these events are virtual. They're all virtual. So they laid the wreath yesterday, and then there will be a virtual job fair. It's going on right now, virtual job fair going on right now. Started at 10, and it will end in about another hour or so at 2. And then on Friday, the 14th, there are two events. One is a symposium at noon, and you can learn how to, you can log, and I'll give you how to log in to get to these events. So there will be a symposium Friday, and then there will be a candle lighting ceremony that night at 7. And then there's a gala that Saturday, which is the actual birthday, and it's an awards, scholarship and awards gala. And that's there. The reception is at 5:15, and then the gala is at 6:30. And then a virtual prayer and reflection program on Sunday, the 16th at 10 a.m. Again, all of this is virtual. A youth field day is at 1 p.m. on Sunday. And then the parade, a virtual parade, get that now, on the actual national holiday, which is Monday. That's at from 10 to 11. Now, the way this virtual parade is going to work is there will be pre-recorded showings and videos and photographs of previous parade highlights, the highlights of previous parades over the more than, about the 40 years of King parades in the Dallas area. And so that ought to be really informative and really interesting. And then, of course, the closing event on Monday from noon to 3 p.m. is a community cleanup in partnership with the Southside Quarter Development Company, the WALL Project, also with Rick Henry Imaging and Urban Specialists at the MLK Corridor on that actual federal day. Which is the National Day of Service. Now, here's how you can log in, and we'll close out with this. BIT, write this down, visit online, bit.ly/2022MLK. I'll say it again. Visit bit.ly/2022MLK. So Martin Luther King, you know, we can't give enough service. The man gave his life. I mean, he gave his life. So what can we give? What are you doing for others? And we want to answer that by doing as much as we can in public service. Let me see if we can let Teddy send us out with his music, if I can find him. I may not be able to find him, but here's someone who's going to help me find Teddy. And he'll give us our closing message. Teddy will give us our closing message. And, you know, the words of his song are just so motivational, I guess you could say. And we want to, he talks about the young people, how teachers need to wake up the young people. He talks about the builders, how we need to, how doctors need to do more to just wake up. Just wake up. And he's telling us, you know, the world's not going to get any better unless we do our part. And so we just got to do it. Teddy's telling us we got to do it, and that he can't do it alone.
Wake up, everybody.
So as we tell you adios, we've had a very informative day. Thank you for tuning in and walking through history. We'll have to have our guest get back again. Let's just listen to Teddy as we say goodbye.
Oh, wake up, all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Get no better if we just let it be. Na 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me. Wake up, all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. Wake up all the builders, it's time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, just you and me.
Wake up, everybody.